Hello friends, welcome to the third season of Grad School Buddy,
a show that simplifies all your questions about graduate school.
Hosting this podcast are Evile Chukwu, an impact storyteller and development analyst,
and Chukwu Ebuka, a development finance specialist with a focus on the private sector of emerging markets.
Every 3 weeks, we highlight the voices and stories of people who have gone through the graduate school journey across different walks of life.
We hope our invaluable insights on this show help you make better graduate school decisions.
3, 2, 1.
Hello,
friend. Hi, friend. Chukwu Ebuka, how are we doing? Hi, your hello.
Hello,
is it? Oh, it's hello that we wrote, though. No,
I know what we wrote.
Hello, friend.
Hi, Kayla. Thank you very much for joining us. I would read your bio and then let you say a few words. So, originally from the Chicagoland area, graduated with dual degrees in economics and political science / international development from Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. During her undergraduate studies, she was fortunate to pursue international research and academic internships with the New Orleans Business Alliance, American Academy of Diplomacy, an education nonprofit in Kenya, and a social enterprise in Paraguay. She interned for the Sub-Saharan African team at the U.S. Trade and Development Agency as a Benjamin A. Gilman International Scholarship recipient and served as a 2022 to 2023 Gilman Alumni Ambassador. Most recently, she finished her tenure as a Youth Ambassador at Expo 2020 Dubai, where she represented Illinois and Louisiana as a cultural ambassador to the USA Pavilion. Inspired by her international experiences and quantitative studies, she then worked as a research assistant in the Africa program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she analyzed and wrote on technology policy and Europe-Africa relations. Outside of work, she founded the Youth International Leadership Initiative, a nonprofit that encourages diverse low-income young people from Middle America to pursue international affairs, careers, and study abroad opportunities. In her free time, she enjoys skateboarding, Olympic weightlifting, and performing with her community marching band at events around Washington, D.C. She's incredibly honored and grateful to be selected as a 2023 Payne Fellow and looks forward to pursuing a career as a private enterprise officer with USAID. I really have some questions from this, but I let you tell us one or two things that are not on this bio.
Sure thing. Thank you all so much for having me. Two things that aren't on the bio. Number one is probably that I performed my first weightlifting competition last weekend. So super excited that that happened. And I'm brand new to weightlifting. So taking that chance and doing something new was really exciting for me. And I'm excited to keep going in the future. And then obviously number two are the things that aren't on the bio, which is obviously everyone's failures. And I feel like to the many successes I've had in my short career, which I'm really thankful for, there are obviously also a ton of failures that wouldn't be mentioned in something so short as a bio. So I can get into that later. There's also a lot of ups and a lot of downs as well.
Abel, I don't know if you had any comments on this.
Sure, we're very happy to jump in. It's always very exciting to hear things about people that you have not known about them before. And one thing I just learned about Kayla is the weightlifting. And I'm very curious to know, you know, how you got into that. But before we fast forward to this Kayla today, we're curious to know about what your childhood was, because I feel like there are a lot of things that happen to us when we're younger that at the point where it's happening, it doesn't really seem like anything. But when you look back and you try to connect the dots, it seems like, okay, yeah, there were things that happened in your life that prepared you for this moment. So can you share with us things that happened in the past that left marks on you and have influenced the person that you are today?
Certainly. I really love this question when I saw you wrote it. So two of the things that have been most influential in my upbringing was being raised in a very maternal household. So I'm the daughter of a single mother. My grandmother is also a single mother. So I've been around like really independent, strong Black woman for my entire life. my mom also is an entrepreneur. And so seeing her, she's a general contractor. So she like rebuilds houses for a living, which is a very male dominated field. So seeing her go into like Home Depot and command the room and know exactly where she's looking and then go to a home she's rebuilding and like command usually her all male staff. But just seeing her in these male dominated spaces has been super influential in making sure that I know I have a voice and can raise it even if I don't know exactly what I'm doing or what I'm talking about. And just seeing her maneuver spaces and be so commanding has influenced me to be more confident as I go throughout my own international development career. Another thing is growing up being a student athlete and musician. So I think both of these practices require a lot of discipline and determination. But you don't come into being an athlete with everything you need to know. You can be naturally athletic, but you need to work really hard and outwork your competition to get to where you need to be. And that's something that I've noticed that not the average person can do. So I grew up being a track and field athlete starting age 4. So I was going to track practice 3 times a week from age 4 until I graduated high school. And then after that, in college, I was also a student athlete. So I was doing athletics 5 times a week for upwards of 30 hours a week. And that was just part of my life. But on the other side, I had to get schoolwork done and hang out with friends. And so I had this idea that if I had to do this, I had to be very organized and I had to be very determined and know what the end goal was. So I think being a student athlete and musician helped me learn discipline, learn to outwork others, and then learn to be organized and always think of the future and what's coming next. So 2 great experiences that really meld together and helped me propel my career, especially being an early career professional.
As someone whose mom and sisters had very huge impact on their lives, I definitely understand having that strong maternal support to lean on. And I'm very glad that you had that. I've had the privilege of seeing Kyla perform with, she said that's not like the whole band, and I want to believe her, but it was really, really cool. So...
Yeah. So how was your time in Kenya?
My time in Kenya was very life-changing. So to put that into perspective, I had never been abroad before. And so getting to Kenya was a journey in of itself. I got a free passport from my university, free funding from my university since I was a low-income student. And with my university, which has a partnership with this nonprofit in Kenya that basically runs a summer camp for kids from the informal settlements of Dagoretti, whose families have been affected by HIV. So they took us over there, me and another student and then a faculty member, and we basically were camp counselors for about 1 month in the summer. And it was my first time abroad ever, which was to Africa. As an African-American, it was super life-changing to recognize that, you know, even though I'm from Chicago and everyone looks like me there, you can travel 15 miles in any direction and that will change very quickly. But landing in the country and seeing like everyone looks like me here and it's going to look like me for hundreds of miles in any direction was something that made me want to keep going abroad more and like understanding the differences and experiences that people have around the world and how I myself as a Black American fit into that new environment. So it was a very fun experience. We were in like a very rural area, living in like a children's school for the summer camp. So that was interesting, just meeting all of these like amazing kids, some of which I keep into contact with on Facebook till this day, and just living a camp counselor experience that I had in the US, but in Kenya, which was definitely just an experience turned around on its head.
Great. Yes, I can really feel the excitement in your voice. I guess another exciting thing that's happened to you recently is being this Payne Fellow. In a few words, what does this fellowship mean to the founder and to you?
So the Payne Fellowship is part of a series of fellowships run by the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to ensure that there is diversity within the Foreign Service. So a lot of people in the Foreign Service now recognize this term called pale male in Yale, which is what the Foreign Service has historically been determined as. The people that travel abroad across the world from the United States were more than just pale male and people that went to Yale. We're a diverse country and we need to show that diversity abroad. So the U.S. Agency for International Development started this fellowship called the Donald M. Payne Fellowship, where they try to recruit underrepresented people into the Foreign Service. So in short, I get to go to grad school for 2 years, completely paid for by the U.S. government. And then afterwards, I start a career in the USAID Foreign Service for 5 years. And then it's meant to be a lifetime career. So I can stay in if I want, or I can move on after this 5 years. And to the founder, Donald M. Payne was a U.S. representative from New Jersey, who was known as Mr. Africa in the House of Representatives. And so having his name be bestowed upon this fellowship is super important because it really shows that the USAID is trying to make big statements in diversity and make sure that the Foreign Service represents the American people. So yeah, that's about it.
Great. I understand clearly in summary, it's to have more diversity, but not just diversity of people, but also of reach. And I guess it makes more sense. The more diverse people you have on the team, the more you can really bring development to people as they want to be developed.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to add 2 points. So some of my co-fellows, people that are in my cohort, actually were recipients of USAID support when they were abroad and then moved to the United States. And now they're paying fellows. So they get to go out into the world and deliver the same support that they actually received when they were in these countries needing assistance. So that's a huge reason why the fellowship exists as well. And another thing is, I think that more diverse people, when you live in the United States, one big thing that you bring to the table is empathy. A lot of the times I'm going to be the only woman, the only person of color in a room in Washington, D.C. And I have to learn how to quickly adapt and how to put myself in these other people's shoes and have them understand my perspective as well. I mean, that's a skill that you learn over time, and you can learn easily when you're, you know, one of an other of some sort, I guess. So I think those are the two things that the fellowship really brings into perspective for a lot of people.
Indeed. And I guess that this also comes with a bit of more responsibility, because you would be in this room where ordinarily there would be no other female or no other person of color, but you have to try to be that sole voice and then to bring that perspective that they would ordinarily not have.
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Something we're also very curious about was about whether or not you knew about the Payne Fellowship. So is this something you've always known about? Is this something that has always been on your radar? I know you talked about how the trip to Kenya exposed you to kind of like a life that you had not been used to before. It exposed you to people, some of whom you're still in contact with. So at what point did you realize, hey, I love the impact that I'm creating right now. I want to continue creating this impact, but also like there is this fellowship that can help me or bring me closer to my goal. What was that process for you?
Yeah, this wraps together with being a low-income student. When you are so low-income, you realize you have to make your own opportunities. And that was me throughout my entire undergraduate career. I went to a predominantly white institution where most people could afford the $80,000 a year tuition. I definitely could not. So I had to figure out how, if I was to go abroad, how could I go abroad? And so I found this scholarship called the Critical Language Scholarship, which takes U.S. citizens abroad to foreign countries to learn a critical language that the United States government needs, basically. But I found the scholarship, and on my campus, we had a fellowship scholarship advisor, someone that was knowledgeable about all these scholarships and the scholarship process. And so I met with her, scheduled a meeting, and I said, I want to apply for the Critical Language Scholarship, introduced myself as someone that was really interested in international affairs, had gone abroad to Kenya during the summer after my freshman year, and wanted to continue down this life path, but also needed the funds to get abroad. And so she sat me down. She was like, thank you so much for meeting me. Here are 5 scholarships and fellowships I want you to look at. And Payne was one of the 5. And so I would not have been able to achieve anything I've achieved without her. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Beers. Big shout out. I love her. And she's been like super instrumental in my journey. So that's how I found out. And I'm so happy I found out at that time, because I was a sophomore in undergrad. And for those of you who don't know, like now I'm four years from then. So 2 years out of school now. So since sophomore undergrad, I began preparing to apply to this fellowship. I knew that I wanted 2 years after undergrad to go to grad school. And I knew that during the 4 years that I had to prepare myself to be the best applicant I could be. So having that leeway from learning about the fellowship to now applying to it, I was able to get organized and be prepared and ready for when the time came to apply.
Okay, so first of all, one of the things that really stands out, one of the things I absolutely love about Kyla is your willingness to always shout out to people. So shout out to the kind lady who told you about these 5 scholarships that you applied to. There was also that sense of dedication and intentionality on your part with regards to the fact that you knew the background that you were coming from, you knew where you wanted to be. And then you met with your scholarship advisor and you started preparing for this moment since your second year. Ibuka, would you like to jump in?
Yeah. I think one thing that jumps out for me is really discipline and trying to outwork the average person. And I guess this is related to my next question. We know that the fellowship has a relatively low acceptance rate, 4%, but you are seeing that that might change. All in all, it's a low percentage of people that are selected at the end of the day. So in your experience, what really sets this 4% or these people that are going to be accepted, what sets them apart from the rest of the applicants?
Great question. So the Payne Fellowship is a super rigorous application process. First, you have to apply. And then after making it to the final round is a one-on-one interview, a group exercise. So you and other finalists have to work together on a group project. And then it's a written portion. So you get about 45 minutes to write an essay about a topic that they give you. I actually signed an NDA. You have to sign it at the start of the interview process. And so I can't go into much of what they ask you to do, but that's the general process that people are aware of. And so it is super tough, which I think why it requires a bit more focus and discipline in terms of applying. So number one, I think successful applicants, they're prepared. So for me, and I think for a lot of other of my fellows, the biographies of past fellows are available online. And many of my fellows have agreed with me that we all read through everyone else's bio. There are hundreds of people, and we just took the time to read through, where is this person from? What have they done in their life? What might have the application committee thought stuck out based on their bio and things like that. So we really studied the bios super well. Next, I think, is creating a team of advisors that will help you informally prepare. So I reached out to some of the previous Payne fellows on LinkedIn, talked to them, discussed like about their experience in the fellowship, what they did before the fellowship that helped them prepare for the application, and things like that. So informally set up those meetings. I also was lucky enough to have a diplomat in residence on my campus. And these are people that are diplomats that take a couple years from going abroad to sit at a university and help bring students into careers in the State Department or in international affairs in general. And so he and I have a very strong relationship. So we sat down and did practice interviews with one another to help prepare for those future one-on-one interviews that I was going to have. He also connected me with other diplomats, former ambassadors, things like that, to walk me through what a career in USAID looks like. So when I came into the interview process, I was prepared to answer the questions that were posed to me about what it would be like situations that I would be in the Foreign Service, and like what I would do to execute on those. So it's a very rigorous application process, but the most successful candidates are ones that are authentic, are prepared, and then use the time they took between learning about the fellowship and applying to really build a really good resume that resonates with why you want a career in the U.S. Agency for International Development in the first place. And I think that truly goes for all fellowships and scholarships, is you have to really prepare yourself and organize yourself, but at the same time, be yourself in the application process, because there's only one person that knows why you want this career, and that's you. So really explaining that is going to help miles in the application process and set you apart.
Great, thanks. So first you do a little research, and then you prepare your application, and you try to be as authentic as possible. Great. Were you surprised eventually that you got this at the end of the day? Do you have that moment of, I worked for this and I got it?
Yeah, of course. I think that's where the team of advisors is really important, because I would go into these practice interviews. I would have people read my application essays and they would tell me, you're good. You're good to go. Like, this is perfect. You're a shoo-in. And I wouldn't believe them. But having their voices in the back of my head saying, you got this, was the thing that helped propel me through the application cycle. I'll be honest, when I walked out of that one-on-one interview, I was like, I really just failed. I'm not going to get this. Next year is going to be my year. At least I know what I have to look forward to. But then I did. So I don't think I had the confidence in myself basically throughout the process. But having a team of advisors and supporters, I think, was a big reason why I tried to stay confident throughout all the pieces of the puzzle.
Thank you for sharing, Kyla. One thing we are also very curious about is the application process. What was your experience, and do you mind sharing some things that stood out to you?
Well, Ebele, I love online applications. They're my favorite thing. It's the interviews that always get me, because I'm like, oh, what if they don't like my personality? But I love applications.
I told you guys that Kyla was weird. You said
it. I hate, like,
I'm glad we are here. We're all hearing it.
I open and I see some things and I'm like, no, this is not
for
me.
You know, if it passes like 5 steps, I'm already over it. I can count the applications that I would say, okay, yeah, this is going to take my body and my soul, but I will do it. And they are not up to 5 a year.
Or even when I think you're asking for too many reference letters or reference letters.
Yeah.
Nah,
yeah, the reference letters get me. I can't. Because I've just asked my people for so many. I'm just like, I feel bad, but I'm in your inbox again asking for another recommendation. But like, that's what these people signed up for when they became my friends. Ebele, you'll be getting a recommendation request from me one day.
I'll pretend to be dead.
Oh my goodness.
But tell us about, so you were so excited about the process, you didn't even see it as anything. You just vibed through it.
Yeah, I consider all these processes a way to earn points. The application was the way I knew I could earn the maximum number of points, because I'm great on paper. To back up, in terms of the applications, they're the easiest parts because you know you can get them right. For applications, it's really important to read through, edit, have other people look at them in terms of like the essays and like everything you write down. And so that's the part where everyone basically can like help you. So if there were like typos in my essays that I sent to my friends, they could see them. If things didn't read well, I could send them to my friends and they could say, this doesn't read well, edit it, things like that. So like, that's where you get the most time to really review your materials. So for the Payne Fellowship, they require a lot of stuff. It requires your financial records. It requires your proof of citizenship. They ask you to send in all the financial aid that you got from your last year of college. They also require 2 essays. The first one, it's a very generic, why do you want to be a foreign service officer with USAID or something like that? And the second one is describe your financial need. And that one's super important. Like, why do you need this funding to go to grad school? Oh, and it requires 2 letters of recommendation. Start early. You definitely need your, make sure your letters of recommendation are strong and ask people that you know, understand what USAID is, understand what a career in diplomacy means, and want to help you succeed in the fellowship. And yeah, I think that's about it with the application process. But that's why I like it so much, is like, it's really a team effort. Everything else happens basically on your own.
And I definitely agree with you about having a community that you send your stuff to, because having people that you can lean on to ask questions about, like, you know, what can I be doing differently and stuff is always very good. But something else that you talked about that I think people often miss is, yes, you need to put in a great application. You need to read between the lines and know what the application is requiring of you. But there is also the point of being yourself and showing up as your best self. I feel like there comes to a point in your career where you're at a place where everybody is badass. And so if everyone is badass, like, what makes you different from every other person? And it's like your personality or that extra razzmatazz that you bring to situations. So thanks for highlighting that as well.
Thank you. Thank you for jumping in, Ebele. Perhaps drift a bit to the various schools you apply to, and why did you choose the schools you chose, and the whole process of choosing the schools, and the feedback at the end of the day, which schools you head back from, which one you chose.
So the interesting thing about the application process for these fellowships is that you apply to the fellowship at the same time you're applying to school. And so basically, I learned that I got the fellowship in February, and my applications for school were due in December to January. You basically have to apply blind and, fingers crossed, hope you get the funding to attend graduate school. So that's what I had in the back of my mind, is if I don't get this fellowship, I truly cannot afford graduate school at this time. So I'll just hold off unless the fellowship happens, and then all of the grad schools are paid for. So I basically applied knowing that no matter where I go, I could probably afford it if I get the fellowship. And if I don't get the fellowship, then I just won't go and I'll wait for another year or defer. So with that in the back of my mind, finances weren't a big deciding factor for me. So I applied to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., American University in D.C., and Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, which is based in D.C. I also applied to Harvard University Kennedy School, and then a couple schools abroad, just in case I didn't get the fellowship, but really wanted to go to school still. I knew I could afford schools in like the UK. So I applied to University of Sussex and Oxford. Those applications were about as rigorous as the Payne Fellowship. So I used a lot of the materials from the Payne Fellowship to apply to the universities. So it was nice to have to submit the Payne Fellowship earlier, so all the materials were already available. In my thought processes, I knew something important to me was I wanted to stay on the East Coast. I also wanted a school of prestige. My top three schools were Harvard Kennedy, Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. My number one school this entire time throughout the application process was Johns Hopkins, but then I ended up getting into all of them. I got additional funding from Harvard Kennedy, but I realized I wanted to be in DC, so that sort of cut off the Harvard thought, even though like technically they gave me the most money out of all of them. And it was basically deciding between Johns Hopkins and Georgetown. I went to the admitted students days for both. And just in terms of diversity, Georgetown was like all the way. For my specific program, they make sure to bring in people from all over to Georgetown. So there are definitely a lot more like international students, a lot more students of color, and a lot more women in Georgetown's program. And that was just the vibe I wanted after going to a predominantly white institution for undergrad. So that was truly the deciding factor. That said, I was able to make this decision without having to think about the price. And I know a lot of people don't have that luxury. So that's why I applied for the fellowship. That was like just a super helpful weight lifted off of my shoulders, is that I didn't have to think about the price. And also Abele went to Georgetown. I actually knew a ton of people that went to Georgetown too, and they were also critical in making that decision. Is just, I knew if I went to Georgetown, I would have like 10 built-in friends already, and they would introduce me to their friend groups and like tell me all the things I needed to know. Whereas going to Johns Hopkins would have been like entirely new. So that was also a deciding factor.
And I guess in choosing the schools, you were also of the opinion that, I mean, nothing was out of your reach, because sometimes when we also want to apply to schools, we say, okay, let's take two top schools and then we just go for the ones with some better acceptance rates and all that they were sure to go to. So what do you think about such idea? Do you think just aim for the top?
Yeah, I am definitely a fan of the reach target safety method. Believe in yourself, go for that dream school, but also make sure you have safeties in your pockets. So that's basically what I did when I applied to grad schools, was hit some reach schools, hit target, and hit safety, because I truly wasn't sure with my grades and test scores whether I could reach a place like Harvard. But then it just happens that my essays were to the standard that they enjoyed. Like, I knew I wanted to apply to really prestigious schools, and Georgetown, Harvard, and Johns Hopkins were the top three for foreign policy. So I chose those, but also chose some other schools that weren't of the top. I think something important about a lot of master's programs, but particularly like foreign policy institutions, like in Washington, D.C., no matter where you go, you're going to get a good education. It's just a matter of where you find your best fit. So I've seen people like from each of these schools, plus a bunch of other schools in D.C. or even in like the country, come to D.C. and get the same job. So it's not like prestige is not as important as it is in undergrad. It's really just like where is giving you the most money? Where do you find you fit in the most? And it'll all work itself out from there.
So I guess my one question for Kyla is, what are you most excited about as you look forward to your degree?
I'm so excited to go back to school in general, point blank period. And I'm also excited to go and study something that I've got the opportunity to learn more about over my last 2 years working, which is why I really appreciated taking time between undergraduate and grad school to really understand the questions that I have. From an academic point, I'm excited about catering my degree towards private enterprise and private sector development. In USAID, I hope to become a private enterprise officer to help with like businesses abroad. And so going into a program where I know I can focus the entire program on learning about how to better do that is super exciting for me. So very different than undergrad, where you can really finesse your program any way you want it. I'm excited to live in Georgetown. It's a very beautiful area. I'm excited to be a student again, to have access to like all the student things that you get to have, all the discount codes online, all the programs that you get to go to around town because you have like student access. So it's going to be a different experience. I've never experienced Washington, D.C. as a student before, but I know there's tons of opportunities for students here. So excited for that.
I'm so excited for you too. I agree. Georgetown is a very beautiful neighborhood. It's very expensive, but it is very beautiful. I can't wait to see what your future holds.
Nice, nice, nice. And in 10 years, where do you see Kyla?
In 10 years and beyond, I know like my ultimate goal is to become a mission director / ambassador, which means I would run the mission / if I become ambassador, run the whole embassy within a country, which means I get to prioritize what the mission and the U.S. embassy focuses on and just be the face of the U.S. for that country. So that'd be probably the ultimate goal in the next 10 years / whatever, however time it takes in the future.
Wishing you the very best. I mean, certainly you would. I think you're one of those people that would set their goals and eventually they achieve it in half the time.
So if you had an opportunity to talk to yourself from 15 years ago, what would your advice to her have been? And then what would you advise like Kyla in her early 20s? Like Kyla who just finished college and is confused, curious, scared, anxious about the world.
I had nothing of my journey planned when I was a teenager. So I think the advice I would give my teenage self is you'll figure it out. I know as a teenager, I didn't think I would have the money to afford to go abroad. And so I just wiped that off of the list of things I was going to do in college. And by the time I graduated college, I went abroad 4 times. So it all will work itself out in the future. And then I think my advice to myself, having freshly graduated from college, is the opportunities will come. So I guess it's a similar thing to like, it'll all work itself out. Like I graduated a year after COVID hit. And by that time, I had received the opportunity to go abroad multiple times that I had to turn down because of COVID. So I also applied to a bunch of fellowships and jobs, and I got some job offers, but the fellowships that I was really looking forward to, I did not end up getting just because of the competitiveness of that year. So I got one fellowship, took it. Ever since then, like I've made the most amazing friends that I have in my life. So it all ended up working out. And I did end up getting to go abroad with that fellowship program particularly too. So even though I failed multiple times, I got so many rejection offers once I graduated from undergrad, but I did end up in a really solid place where I can say that like this was all meant to be.
One thing I love about you is you're not afraid to talk about failures. And this is something I tell people every time, like the fact that people win is because they have failed so many times. And it's something that you have mentioned multiple times in this interview. It's something you've mentioned that you have dealt with. That was even how you started off when we asked the first question. And you seem to handle failure really well. So what does that seem like when things are not going great, even in the present? How do you deal with failure as an emotion and as something that you experience?
One thing that I think has been super helpful is just having the community. I, over time, have just built this solid community where they'll root for me, but also they're there if I fall, and I fall a lot. So they're always there to like help cheer me up. We'll go out, we'll talk through all the things, and they're there to help me process those emotions. Another thing I have that has made rejection so much easier is I have this little rejection folder in my email inbox. And so if I ever apply to something, whether that's a job or a fellowship, and I get a rejection, I just slide it into that folder. And during that time of adding it to the folder, I look through all the other things that I did not get. And I sit there and I think of all the applications I filled out and like, would I have liked my life 10,000 times more if I had received any of these opportunities? And I'm like, no, I like where I'm at pretty solidly. So the fact that I didn't receive this last one that I didn't get, like, it's not going to affect my journey at all. It would have been great. It might have helped really well, but I like how everything turned out, even though I didn't get all of these different fellowships I applied for. So I think that has been super helpful in looking back and realizing that just because I didn't get all these things I applied for didn't affect the trajectory of my life and how much I love my life right now. So I think that has been super helpful. And I'd recommend everyone have a rejection folder in their inbox. I've also like recently started my acceptances folder and it hasn't been quite as fulfilling. So I think the rejections is like the good way to go. Okay. That was a joke. Sorry.
No, it was a good joke. I feel if I start my acceptance folder, it'd be empty.
Excuse me, that's the joke. Where are you? Yeah, I think there's always going to be something in our acceptance folder. Yeah, but that's a really nice way to think about life. Yeah.
Yeah. How do y'all deal with rejection in your own special ways, or just? I hate the word rejection too, because they're not rejecting you; they're just accepting somebody else.
I think it depends on the day. And like you said, sometimes you look at some things you were rejected from and you realize right now I can say that I am exactly where I have always wanted to be. This is where Billy from 5 years ago wanted to be. So I just try to remind myself, even with everything that I thought I always wanted that I got rejected from, I'm still where I used to journal about wanting to be. And that keeps me grounded. And then the second thing is like, I honestly feel like I meet a lot of brilliant people every day, like people I have never even come across, like our paths have never crossed. And I'm like, oh my God, how is this person so smart? And I ask myself, so if all of us who think like, hey, we're doing cool stuff, or you know how you have like maybe 10 days out of the week, you're like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm doing. But that one day where you feel like I actually know my stuff. And so if everybody that knows their stuff applies to something, the competition is very tough. But I just remind myself that we are all brilliant in our own ways, right? The fact that they chose somebody else doesn't make you less brilliant. It means like this particular place is not for you at this time. I can't lie and say it doesn't hurt. It really, really hurts, especially if you go through a rigorous process. Like you go through asking people to read it. You go through asking friends to organize mock interviews for you. You go through asking your referees. Honestly, it's very embarrassing. I had to take like a 6-month break because I'm like, I'm done asking my referees for stuff. I know that, yes, I've had acceptances, but I've had a whole lot of rejections. And I know they say they don't care. But sometimes you just feel like it's a bit too much. That's how I deal with failure. Hey, Buka, how do you deal with failure?
Well, how do I deal with failure? So first, I mean, I get it and I'm like, you know, there's that numbness and yeah, but what has happened is that throughout my life, the things I applied for, I didn't get, and the great jobs or opportunities I've had, I didn't formally apply for. So my career in development finance, this is somewhere I thought I would be, let's say, at least 6 more years from now, and I got it, let's say, 7 years prior without applying. It was at a birthday party that I met my current boss, and we got talking, and yeah, we worked for a while. Another opportunity came up and I just got in. So for me, it's that what keeps me going is that, so whenever I get a rejection in my head, it's like, yeah, it's something I want, but not something that I need. And I just move on. Yeah. So that's really how I deal with failure. It's that the great things that are for me would always come, and those that I'm rejected, they are nice things, but they might have been stumbling blocks. So they've just been removed out of my way and I have to just forge ahead.
Period. I also think what both of y'all are doing with this podcast is a really good way to get over that idea of failure. So one thing that I always look back on is I always try to be sort of a mentor and like lift as I climb personally. And I find that even making like the smallest impact of like talking to someone for 15 minutes about life and work and like how I got to where I am helps me reflect and realize like I'm at a place that someone wants to be in the future. And Ebele has been that for me. So I just wanted to highlight her in that, like, even when we were working together, like in the same office, I would always be like, Ebele, what do you think about this random thing? And she's always was always so willing to like talk to me about her experiences going to Georgetown, starting a nonprofit, all of it. So thanks, Ebele, for all of that.
Kyla, you know, I don't know what to do like when someone says cool stuff. Great, great. Stay out of trouble. Thank you.
I know, it gets you all flustered.
Listen. Thank you for thanking us, Kyla.
Thank you very much, Kyla. So, you have such an amazing bio. You seem to have it all figured out. In the academic aspect, the social aspect, and everything. So, how do you manage everything?
Yeah, this is also a mystery to me. I have no idea. I think I'm actually pretty bad at this, and this is something I'm currently working on myself, is creating a work-life balance. Right now I'm vibing because my fellowship at the House of Representatives is over. I'm planning a barbecue in honor of the new Barbie movie, and I'm also doing a couple nonprofits on the side. But for me, balancing like social life and being the best friend, the best partner, the best coworker, like the best nonprofit leader, it's all by the seat of my pants. Is that a saying? So yeah, this is a question for me too. I do not know. One thing I think has helped me is writing everything down. I'm the type of person, if I don't write it down, I will forget it immediately. So making note of it, putting it in multiple places, and like sitting myself down at a laptop and finally doing it at the end of the day has helped, I guess.
You know, when people do just great stuff and they're like, you know, it's
yeah,
nothing.
I just do it. Like,
exactly.
I'm like, wow. You mean you just write it down and everything balances?
Are you doing
that? Yeah, because we must be writing wrong.
No, I will.
Okay, but Kyla, for people who have vibed with you, or actually just want to ask you career-related questions, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn at Kyla Denwood. I'm the only Kyla Denwood out there, I'm sure. Ooh. Of it, because I have not seen a single other Kyla Denwood on this planet. And then they can also find me, just email me at kdenwood@tulane.edu. I still use my college email. But yeah, that's it. And if you want an invite to my barbecue, feel free. There should be plenty of hot dogs for everybody.
Well, by the time they listen, it will be too late. The barbecue would be over. I might attend and tell you guys how it turned out. Chukwuebuka, unfortunately, you don't have that luxury.
You can come too. It's okay. You can fly out.
Exactly.
It's been so amazing hearing your story, from coming from a minority background, being in this place where you help people from similar backgrounds as you, and also people in the international community. I really, really love that you shared very vulnerable stories with us about the challenges that you had, the failures that you had, but also like the successes that you had, and how you've been able to put all of your experiences together into creating this career for yourself. We wish you the best in your grad school experience, and we hope to spend more time with you sometime in the future.
I'm wishing you all the very best.
Yeah, thank you all both, Chikwagubuka and Ebele. I'm so happy to be here, and yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, listeners, for listening. See you on the next episode.